Brenda C. from DCN.
Hi, group. I'm Brenda, blessed recovering addict. Can I first get out the way? I don't want to be here. I don't like talking about me. But grief is one of the things that I know a lot about. If I get that off the top. Thank you. Oh, you're saying that I'm a little high challenge that I need to down a little bit? Okay. Okay, so I'm going to repeat myself. Don't want to be here. Don't like talking about me. I like to talk. But when it comes down to talking about me, it becomes difficult a lot of times. The only thing is, grief is one of the things that I'm most familiar with. And I know the topic is grief and recovery. My experience that brought it with me. Let's see. 37 years ago, I came down to Ocean City, and I was up at the Fenwick. My baby at the time was 8. She had just got out of school on June 14th. I found out she was a diabetic a week before she turned 3. She had started going to camp. She knew how to give herself her insulin. Things were fine. I had never been more than 20 minutes away. D.C., Maryland, Virginia, I could get there, wherever she was. I've had police calls follow me without stopping me because I had to get to where she was because either she was going into a diabetic coma or she wasn't breathing. And nobody else gave her insulin. Nobody else. I mean, my mother would watch her, but when it came down to her health and anything else dealing with that, I was dead. Now, at the time, like I said, she was 8, just got out of school June 14th. A friend of mine, my girlfriend and her husband, we came down to come for the weekend. I called her and said, baby, mommy's not going to get over there, but I will see you on Sunday. This was 2 o'clock Friday afternoon. I got down here, and she said, okay. She was going to go to camp the next week. She learned how to give herself her insulin. Everything was fine. I get down here at 9 o'clock Saturday morning. I get a call from my mother saying that she had taken my daughter to Children's Hospital. And I said, okay. I had made arrangements with Children's Hospital years before because when I was hospitalized, nobody gave her insulin. So long as my mother or somebody took her to the hospital, they would give her the insulin shot. And this was back in 1976. Needs to say, in 1979, I came down here. My mother said, oh, I brought Barbara over to the hospital. You know, she didn't want to give herself her insulin. I said, okay. My girlfriend and I came up to Fenwick, walked down the boardwalk, came back. By the time I got back to Fenwick at 11 o'clock, I got another call saying, call Children's Hospital. The doctor wanted to talk to you. Okay. And they were asking for permission to drill a hole in my child's head because she had gone into a coma and stopped breathing. Now, mind you, my girlfriend and her husband decided it was a beautiful weekend. They wanted to stay. So I had to catch a bus back home. Bus didn't leave until 5 o'clock. I didn't leave back to 12th Street until 10:30. So by the time I got to Children's Hospital, of course, my child was in a coma with a tube in her head and IVs everywhere. Now, mind you, that was not my first episode. By the time I was 17, my son was diagnosed with glaucoma, and he was operated on his eyes at 3 months old. Still in school, you're the mother, it's your fault. It's your fault when your child has an illness. It's your fault when your child needs to take insulin. Of course, the people that love you the most tell you it's your fault, so it must be true. You know, so my friends who didn't know how to help me, said, drink this, smoke this, suck this, you'll feel better. I just wanted to stop hurting because there was nobody there to say, it's going to be okay. And I should always say, God, it wouldn't be so bad if I didn't have to do it all alone. Well, needless to say, my dear dog's sweet husband at the time, I would go to the hospital. I had two other children at home, my son's one eye, my three-year-old, and she was now six years old. And I said, please just come up to the hospital and sit in the waiting room. He said, I don't care what you're going to do, I'll get there when I get there. So I said, if she died, I'll never tell you, somebody else will. And that I didn't, and that they did. But then you have a job and say your child or your child. So now you got a child 3 years younger, a child 3 years older, so you got to take them out, feed them, go to work, come to the hospital, and say, God, it wouldn't be so bad if I didn't have to do it all alone. Needless to say, that child will be 44 come July 12th. This was 1979. Okay, let's jump forward now. I came, all I wanted was somebody to say, it's okay, you know, I'll be there, you know, I'll hold your hand. You can't change anything, but I'll be there and I'll hold your hand. Needless to say, that six-year-old found out she was adopted for her 10th birthday. She had blocked out memories of her sister at the time because she was six. So now by the time she's 10 and somebody's coming here now, she's a diabetic. All these memories are flooding back. She started running away from home. Of course, whose fault was she running away from home? It was mine because I was the mother. And there was no love in the home. I've been going saying, I just need some help. Well, you're making $5,800 a year. Your husband's trying to kill you and he won't let you live in a house. So, okay. So, I'm sitting at work. I don't cry. I was always afraid of crying. If my child saw me crying, I wouldn't be able to help them. They might get sick thinking that mommy was not there for them. Drink this, smoke this, suck this, you'll feel better. I just wanted somebody to be there and hold my hand. Just to say it's going to be okay. Not everybody, including my mother who loved me dearly, is your fault they're diabetic, it's your fault they're not there. I'm not giving them any insulin. You need to get money and you need to eat and you need to. Okay. I work for the criminal prevention department of justice. They said, you need to be here. Drink this, smoke this, suck this. It'll make you feel better. They could help me. That's the only thing they knew to make me feel better. I don't know if you understand what it feels like to have a ton of bricks on your chest. They hurt so bad, but when you go to work, you got to dress as though you know what it's like to be there. And then you can't get food stamps or medical help for your children because you're making $5,800 a year and your name is on a poster to your husband that they tried to kill you. But you can't get any help. Needless to say, that 10-year-old that started running away from home, the last time she went to Children's Hospital, and they said, oh, she can be released. I said, then you need to keep her. Says, I'm such a terrible mother. So, of course, they came out and investigated me in the whole 9 yards, and then she tried to run away from the hospital. I said, oh, that must mean you must be terrible nurses. But needless to say, they took me to court. What I learned was never give up full custody. I gave up joint custody because I want to know where they're taking my child, what they're going to do with her. And I want to be involved. So they did. I had to pay $100 child support to the court. Their father, as of that date, was over $50,000 in arrears to the court. And he didn't have to pay because I had custody of her, and of course it's the mother's fault because you have a job and you have a husband, therefore it's your child and we're taking doing it for you, so you have to pay. So they took the $100. Needless to say, when my child finally said, Mommy, I'm better, she was now 20 years old, and she said, I'm pregnant. Are you upset? I said, no, baby, you're over 18. It's your child, and it's okay. I'm going to be there for you, but I ain't got to take care of this one. Needless to say, by the time she was 23, She had a 3-year-old child. She had on her 20th birthday. My child just turned 41 years old. My granddaughter, thank God, just turned 21. But by the time I had 8 months clean, that child wound up in an alley in a garage at 17th and Euclid because someone decided to put her body in a car because they thought she was OD and O crap. When it was her blood sugar that was going up that caused her to become those same symptoms that crack addicts have. You become lethargic. You can hear, you can't respond. You have glassy eyes, sweaty palms. So, what else do? You can't stay here. We put you in a car, in an alley, in a garage. So by the time I got to IG her body in the morgue, she was also so badly decomposed that I didn't tell them that she was a diabetic because I didn't want to believe that it was my child because she had a 3-year-old that she needed to come home and take care of. God, it would be so bad if I didn't have to do it all alone. So God had a wonderful sense of humor. I told you before I got here, everybody said, you got to do it here, go there, do that. Well, there was an addict who I thought was my boyfriend who had moved on, and I called him one day and said, when did we break up? So we'd be on the same page. Because needless to say, I came here to get some help from him. It wasn't because I needed help, because I'm a caretaker coach in the neighborhood. I want to be in control. And I don't know if some of you may or may not know, I did look up grief and started in denial saying, I'm in denial, I can't be really happy because I'm in control, so things should be working a different way and I should be able to take care of this, I should be able to handle this, and nothing is working. It's called, I want to be in control. It's also called denial. I don't want to believe that what's really going on is happening. Needless to say, that same addict who moved on to someone else, but because we both came in recovery together, we took on an addict, never alone. He never left my side when I needed to go to the hospital, when I went to go and I need a body, when I went to go look for the body. To this day, 18 years later, he always answers my call, even though he has a wife now. And he's moved on because we've learned how to respect each other and respect each other's boundaries. But we are never alone with each other. Because that's what you all taught us. Needless to say, it didn't stop there. My dear Donald T. Lobo, I called him a AAA, Arrogant Asshole Harris. He just turned 47 and decided that, Mommy, you need to call me on the camera. You need to tell me what to do and you need to do. I said, what? I need to rework you, right? Anyway. Well, needless to say, I was watching my mother, which was his grandmother, who happened to fall on my watch and break her hip. One more time. I took my eyes off her for 5 minutes. I have a step down room and she got up from the table and just that fast fell and broke her hip. Well, hip healed. She decided she didn't want to walk anymore. I learned from being in here that it was a blessing because I don't know how I would have gotten help for her, carrying her up the steps, feeding her, taking care of her, if she was not already in that rehab where they allowed her to stay. For one more time, being here, never alone. I was never going to be alone because I'm the one that went from Bowie to Northeast to dress her, feed her, take her to Georgetown, to her doctor's appointments because she refused to come over to my house and spend the night. When she died, my sister and I chose to cremate her. Of course, it was our fault that nobody had any money to bury her and have a burial, even though we took care of her. But my nieces and my son and everybody that loved me said, you could have mortgaged your house. And I said, where was I going to live after I mortgaged my house? I wouldn't be able to pay for it. Are you going to help me pay? No, but you can't. I said, well, anybody that wants to any of we were there for our mother. My sister and I fed her, clothed her, washed her behind. We knew every crack and crevice from her toenail to the top of her head. She never had a shot like my children. I always held her head because she said, you know, with older people, my mother used to always say, once an adult, twice a child.
So when she got 85 and couldn't remember, and asked me to say it 10, 15, 20 times, I would say, okay.
What'd you say? Did I eat? I learned to do one of two things. Either you repeat the answer, or you ignore them because they're going to ask you again 2 seconds later. So go either way. The one thing you don't do is tell them you already told them, because then they become defensive and all of that. And so I learned how to do that too. So I'm a caretaker, codependent neighbor that learned how to take care of people, and I brought the grief with me, but I learned how to get through it in here. And the one thing that I found with this grief process, and I looked it up, and one of the things that people always say, fear and faith can't dwell in the same space. If you know that fear means respect of that which you have no power over, you will realize that if you fear God, that means you respect that which has that you have no power over, but has all power, then you will realize that fear and faith does dwell in the same space. Or at least it has for me. I respect the fact that what it is, and it gets along. And then I looked up the other list. It says, a feeling of respect and wonder for something very powerful. So if you think that you're afraid of something, look at something that you respect. I respected God because of what it'll do. I'm afraid of what you might do with it. The storms and all of that, and the storms that you go through life. And the one thing that I also love about the grief process and the ending process of never alone, because even in that, I said, wow, whoever wrote this must have been in NA, because it also says you don't have to face this alone. Ask someone you trust for support. Writing can help. I said, Dad, sounds like NA. Whoever wrote this about grief must have been in NA. So usually, a lot of people know that when I hold my arms out like this, I can't change it. But I want you to feel differently, knowing you can get through it. It's not going to change the pain, but it helps you get through it. Now, any other thing? I had never reconstructed surgery. For those of you that don't know what that is, that means that they didn't know how to help me, but they figured they go in and cut some part off, they gave me bags hanging down my legs and some more stuff. So I had a choice. Either I could stay with the pain of being sick, or I could let someone help me get through the pain and getting better. And I think that's what we do it here. Doesn't mean the pain is going to go away. It doesn't mean that you're going to stop hurting. But it means that you're going to be able to get through it. But don't try to do it by yourself. Let somebody just hold your hand, give you a hug, and say, I love you, with no strings attached. And that's been my story. I'm still not crying. Sorry. I still don't. But I'm so grateful to be part of a fellowship that says you're never alone. And like I said, after 8 months when my child first went missing, God said, oh, you said you didn't want to be alone. Here it is. Giving you the same situation. Now, how are you going to deal with it now? And that's the way. Like I said, my baby just turned 41. My oldest daughter will be 44 in July. And my dear daughter's sweet son just turned 47. And the blessing is, you get through it. And you get through it with somebody holding your hand, brushing your hair, rubbing your feet, and just somebody giving you a hug saying they love you. Guess what? I love you. Thanks for letting me share.
At this time, I would like to introduce our second speaker.